Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, tens of thousands of Arizonans seem to have dropped their health care coverage as premium prices have gone up.
And five musical takes on love for your Valentine's Day playlist.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Taxpayers are filing their tax returns today, and those tax returns are on forms that will only comply with the law if we adopt this bill and the governor signs it.
There isn't a problem of confusion because of the forms. The forms are legal, and by state law, if you follow the forms and then the legislature makes a conformity change, no penalties and no interest.
Hospital systems are burdened because of illegal aliens, okay? That means that American citizens get a lower quality of care because of that burden.
Right now, we know that no personal information is safe from being given over to ICE, who is killing people in the streets, including United States citizens.
Now, this is a critical moment to show this administration that they can't keep undermining the freedoms that generations of Americans like me went to war to defend.
The judge's perspective on that question was, he's a big boy. He's an elected official. You're elected officials. You're equals. You can work this out between yourselves.
It's as if they broke it and they want to blame somebody else for breaking it. These are fragile systems. They're very old systems. They're very outdated systems. And I've been trying to get the resources to have my team fix them.
And with me to talk about the GOP gubernatorial primary getting a little less crowded, more lack of consensus on tax conformity, and more, our former state lawmaker, Regina Cobb. Regina, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
And Don Penich of Agave Strategy. Don, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
So, Regina, let's talk about Karen Taylor Robeson. Yesterday afternoon, she sent a press release saying that she was suspending her gubernatorial campaign. What do you make of the fact that she's calling it quits?
To begin with, I was totally surprised. And I loved the statement she made. I admire Karen and respect her very much. I'm hoping that it isn't anything personal, that it is just what she said, that this is something that, she's trying to bring the party together. If you read between the lines, I kind of wonder if Andy Biggs is getting a little more intelligent and there's a possibility of Karen Taylor Robeson maybe being a lieutenant governor. Mm. That's a possibility. I don't know. But I was floored by it.
In her statement, as you alluded, she wanted to avoid a messy, contentious intra-party primary. Does her getting out of the race achieve that?
I don't know if it does or not. It depends on whether or not Swigert's still staying in the race or not. You know, the rumors out there is that he's possibly getting out of the race. This could be a single person primary. If Swigert gets out of the race and gets back into the congressional race in District 1, then we're sitting with one candidate. So it wouldn't be a messy, primary. I don't think it was going to get messy. I think everybody was still being pretty respectful at this point, but I think that she just didn't want to split the party.
Don, what do you make of the fact that Karen Taylor Robeson, who seemed to have a lane, the sort of the conventional wisdom was that sort of the non-MAGA Republicans, sort of the traditional establishment business-oriented Republicans would go to her. Now that she's out, where does that leave the primary, do you think?
Well, I think that we saw in her initial run and in the last recent several months that she was struggling to try to walk that line of the Trump endorsement that she was the first to get, but still also maintain this, like, I'm the more moderate candidate that the general election will be able to, support. And that's a really hard line for someone to walk, for any Republican to walk these days. But I think I was a little less surprised because from one perspective, as soon as Schweiker and Biggs started jumping in, I think you really saw a lot of momentum immediately gravitate in that direction of two very established, very talented politicians. A lot of funding was going that way. And it just felt like Robeson was losing kind of that spotlight that she had had before. So I was less surprised by this. But looking at it from, you know, Governor Hobbs' perspective, any incumbent wants their opponent's primary to be as expensive and as messy as possible. And so her stepping out of this, even if the two gentlemen left in don't unite, as the calls for them to do are, it will be less expensive potentially and less toxic with one less person in. And so from Hobbs' perspective, you know, that's unfortunate. You want that to get as nasty as possible over there. And so for sure, they're rooting for nobody else to drop out and for this to be expensive.
But Don, when you talk about money, Andy Biggs is supported by Turning Point.
Right.
So it would stand to reason that money is probably not going to be an issue, even if the primary is ridiculously expensive, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's what I refer to is, you know, he's got that support. As soon as he jumped in, there was this groundswell and financial support behind him, and that will remain.
Regina, do you anticipate that Karen Taylor Robeson will ultimately endorse one of the candidates, assuming that both Biggs and Schweiker stay in? Do you think that ultimately she'll endorse? Because she didn't yesterday.
She did not, but I think she will. Yeah. I don't see her staying out of the race. I think that her influence that she's had up to this point is probably going to be needed. But I agree with Don. It's not going to get as messy. Does not bode well for Hobbs. And you know, we've been saying along these lines that, you know, if it does get messy, Hobbs has a good shot at winning. So hopefully this reduces that for the Republican Party, and they can come together.
So, Don, if you are Governor Hobbs' team right now, and again, assuming that both the candidates who are in today stay in, do you have a preference as to which one you face going into November?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think the general feeling is that Biggs is the stronger candidate of the two, the strongest in the field. And so, you know, Governor Hobbs' team is just going to focus on that general electorate that maybe will be persuaded by, you know, sound clips or transcripts of Biggs having said things in his long career that are too extreme for the average American independent, Arizona independent in particular. You're going to stay focused on, you know, her needing to stop some of the more extreme efforts coming out of both Washington and the legislature. So you're going to focus on her platform and bank and invest that she is the candidate that will appeal to more of that middle, and that they won't be able to get footing with Biggs as the moderate he'll need to pivot to being for the general.
Is Congressman Biggs able to make himself into a moderate, or does he need to be?
No, Congressman Biggs would never be a moderate. And I think that if I was Hobbs, I would want him to be my opponent, because I think there's going to be a strong distinction between the two of them. And if Biggs gets in, it's going to be a lot like with Kerry Lake, the same type of race that you ran with Kerry Lake. I think if I were Hobbs, I would want Biggs, even though he's the stronger candidate. I think that Schweiker could shift that direction. He could go to more.
He's
to a
won
moderate.
Very close races in kind of a swingy district.
He did. Last year it was like I think the last election cycle was 1 or 2 points over Amish Shaw, and I mean that was really close. So he has won a moderate district. So if I were Hobbs, I wouldn't want to go against that. Hmm. I would probably want to go against Biggs.
Okay. So the primary is coming up over the summer, a little bit sooner for Arizonans. We've got to file our income taxes. And right now, we don't really know what the rules of the road are for filing Arizona income taxes. The state legislature this week passed their second tax conformity bill. Governor Hobbs yesterday issued her second veto of this. Regina, is there any hope for the sides coming to an agreement on what from the federal One Big Beautiful Bill Act Arizona will adopt?
Well, they're going to have to come to an agreement pretty soon here, because the taxpayers do need to know this. This is something we've done every year. We've had to conform every year. This one's a little bit more difficult, I think. And
There's more to it.
It's divisive. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's why it's taking a little bit longer. But they're going to have to. Just like they have to come up with a budget every year. They don't always agree at the beginning, but guess what? They've come up with it. So the taxpayers need to know, and as it gets closer to April 15th, it's going to be do D-Day for these guys. They gotta come together.
Well, so, Dawn, as Regina has said, and she knows from her experience on the Appropriations Committee, yes, the legislature and the governor do ultimately come to agreement on a budget. That, though, can take months to do. Right now, they don't have that time, right? They have to get this done. People are starting to file their taxes now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel it. You know, outside of the political insider stuff, I'm just someone who wants to be able to file my taxes and know that I'm not going to have to do it again because I hate it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the governor has been extremely clear that she is going to continue vetoing these full conformity bills that get to her desk. And I believe her. You know, the tax cuts that she wants to put forward are in the hundreds of millions. They are going to impact a good swath of Arizona families and taxpayers. And I think she's going to stick to her guns. And, you know, Republicans are going to need to look at this year and say, okay, we didn't get everything this year. And they'll need to turn that into a talking point for their own campaign trails that everyone wants to get to because, as you said, their clock has been turned back 2 weeks and they want to hit those campaign trails.
Well, so do you get the sense that there's any give in the governor's stance here? Like, is it my way or the highway, or is there some room for negotiation with Republicans?
Well, there's been some issues out there that, you know, people are saying, like Prop 123, so school funding being clean funding and not wrapping in, you know, the private school scholarships, that there are some negotiation points out there. But again, the ninth floor is messaging very strongly, nope, we're not doing it. We are not expanding these tax cuts and doubling the hit to the Arizona General Fund.
Regina, do you think that's a wise stance by the governor to sort of draw this line in the sand? And seemingly so far, it doesn't seem as though there have been a whole lot of talks.
Yeah, I don't think it's a wise stand. I think the public is going to eventually get into this. And the private person is going to say, hey, I can't file my taxes. Get something done. And everybody's going to take a little bit of a hit on this. There has to be compromise. I mean, there's no way that you can just say it's my way or the highway. I think at the beginning you start out that way, but then you have to start moving.
Well, and Republicans have now passed two bills that the governor has said before they passed them that she was going to veto. So I guess both sides really seem to need to get in a room together and figure this out.
Yep. And just like, I mean, we've passed a budget for the last 5 years on June 27th to June 30th because we don't want the – yeah. So there's going to be a deadline, and they have to get in a room and do things before that deadline. I think they will.
Dawn, let me start with you on a new effort by the Arizona Education Association and Save Our Schools Arizona. They're launching an initiative to try to do what they want the legislature to do, which it hasn't, which is to rein in a bit the state's universal school voucher program. Among the changes that they're proposing, $150,000 income limit for eligibility, background checks on folks working in schools, requirements for assessments of students who get ESAs. This is obviously a heavy lift. They have 200,000+ signatures they've got to collect by early July. Is this doable in the amount of time they have?
It is doable, yes. You know, between the amount of volunteers and grassroots folks who are motivated around this issue and the fact that, again, as you said, the teachers union will bring in some good funding to help with that signature collection effort. It's a tall order, but it is very doable. And I think that they're motivated to do so as those two groups. There have been a lot of headlines about this. We've been seeing this at this point year after year. And so I think to me, the bigger question is whether anyone in the legislature will say like, oh, we don't want to see that happen. Let's see if we can bring back some of the many bills over, you know, that have been introduced that go nowhere. Or is there anything that we can do? You know, we've seen legislatures before put competing measures on a ballot to try to confuse voters. So the story is not written yet.
Mm. Well, Regina, that's an interesting point because obviously if something is voter approved, it's much more difficult for the legislature to change it. Might this be an issue, as Dawn alluded to, that the legislature maybe does something that's more palatable to them to sort of head it off or maybe put something on that, as you talked about Prop 123, you know, maybe put some of the ESA program into the state constitution?
I agree with Dawn on this one. There's a lot of – it's the story is not written. And what we look at when we look at initiatives. Initiatives are a good thing. They should be coming from the public. What we saw, what we've been seeing with initiatives is they're not necessarily coming from the public. They're coming from special interest groups. And I think that that's difficult because when you look at some of the initiatives that we have, they have things built in that we just don't expect. So I think what Don said about them putting a competing initiative out there is probably a good strategy and probably will be seen. And like you said, it could be inclusive of Prop 123. It could be things that the public wants more than they want accountability in the ESA program. When you look at this initiative and it says $150,000 for a family of six, that's not a lot. You know, especially when a mom and dad work. So I think there's some specifics in this that are difficult to swallow. So I think that they're going to have a hard time with this. But I think a competing initiative is what really we're going to be seeing.
Dawn, let's assume that it does make the ballot just for conversation's sake. What do you think the campaign for this initiative looks like? Because there are now more than 100,000 students who use the universal ESAs. And in a sense, you know, you might think, OK, well, it's costing too much. You know, people are buying stuff with this money that they shouldn't buy. But on the other hand, there are also a lot of families who are using this who probably don't want to lose it.
Yeah, that's very true. But there are a lot more families who all they know of this program is the nonstop headlines about fraud, misuse, lack of accountability. And so, I mean, I've been looking at data over, you know, ESA vouchers for several years now. Every single time vouchers go to a ballot in the United States, they fail. Hmm. And I think that this is a sure thing that if Arizona voters get to say yay or nay, it will go down. There might be some details in there that, oh, maybe that 150 should be a little bit higher. But ultimately, faced with a yes or no decision, Arizona voters will vote that they want these regulations, these income caps, this accountability applied to the program. I have absolutely no doubt about that.
Regina, would you agree that if this makes the ballot, we're going to be reading a lot and seeing a lot of commercials featuring things like diamond rings and trips to Disneyland and vasectomy kits and things like that?
Absolutely. That's exactly what you're going to be seeing it's going to focus on that piece of it. Like I said, I hope the voters read through the ballot measure and see because, I mean, when we raised minimum wage, there was a lot of things in there that the voters didn't know about. And then all of a sudden they were calling me as a legislator afterwards saying, how can I change this? And I'm like, you really can't. Once a vote initiative is done, it takes a lot for it to be undone. And the pieces can't be taken out of it. It's got to further the cause of the initiative.
All right. So, Dawn, that would be in the general election. You guys both alluded to the calendar for legislators. The state legislature has moved up the primary, made it earlier. It's now July 21st, the last Tuesday in July. So that would be July 21st this year. And it's not just the day that people vote. Like, there are a lot of other deadlines that are associated with Election Day. That's all getting moved up. What does that mean for people running for office?
It's pandemonium, I'll tell you that, as someone who is running multiple campaigns right now. It moves up when ballots are going to start to come out, which means that as a candidate or an issue campaign, you're moving up when you need that mail delivered. You're moving up when you need to fundraise to pay for all those mail and commercials and everything else. And right now, what we're seeing and feeling is every candidate, even if they're an incumbent, has to collect signatures in order to put themselves on a ballot here in Arizona. For some folks, depending on, you know, the size of their districts, for some folks, that's several hundred signatures. For some, it's thousands. So candidates all over are just rushing around trying to collect these signatures with 2 weeks less than they thought they were going to have.
Yeah.
And it's tough. You know, as Arizonans, we have the Citizens Initiative process, so we're used to folks outside of our grocery stores collecting signatures. But when you're a candidate, it's actually tighter restrictions on who can sign those petitions for you and all kinds of stuff. It's a big job.
Yeah, Regina, what are you hearing from some of your former friends, your current friends, but former colleagues in the state legislature?
They're all panicking right now, and especially the incumbents that are sitting there and can't get out and are working Monday through Thursday. And and only have Friday, Saturday to really get out and get their signatures. They're having a difficult time, and they're not seeing a lot of activity on the Equal system, which is the, you know—
You can get electronic signatures for candidates.
Yes, and of course, you know, the Equal system went down this last week. That was a panic mode for everybody. It's not just Republicans it's Democrats, Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
Whoever is an incumbent doesn't have that advantage of getting out there and being able to actually get the signatures they need.
Is there a thought that this might sort of, I don't want to say equalize, but maybe give challengers a bit more of a chance against, because typically incumbents, you know, the rate of incumbents who get reelected is usually pretty high. Does this maybe lower that somewhat?
I don't think so. What it's probably going to do is the incumbents are going to start paying for people to go out and get signatures for them. So it's going to cost their campaigns more. So I don't think it's actually going to equalize. I've been saying this for years. Getting signatures as an incumbent is something that it is cumbersome. The public doesn't like it. Once they're in, I think it getting those same amount of signatures again every 2 years is just redundant. And so I honestly, and I've never seen anybody that, you know, we saw last year, I think, someone that didn't get the signatures and ended up fraudulently getting signatures because of that. But for most incumbents that work pretty hard, it's not difficult to get the signatures at the very end of the day.
You still prefer those 2 extra weeks, though, right?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh, when they moved up the primary last time, it was difficult. Now, 2 weeks earlier, yeah. I would be panicking if I were in office.
Don, is there a sense that this might affect work at the legislature for incumbents to not be there Monday through Thursday? Like, could we see them, you know, take one of those breaks in the middle where they're, you know, they come in maybe once a week or take a couple weeks off or maybe even finish their work earlier?
You know, every single election year session, we say, you know, everyone wants to hit the campaign trail. They're going to be motivated to get out of here faster. But like Regina said, nevertheless, we see it go to end of June. And everything that I'm hearing, everyone I'm talking to is saying this is a particularly tense, conflict-ridden session. It's probably going to go just as long, even though they're all freaking out over those signatures.
Is that what you're hearing as well, Regina?
I am. And you know, when you talk about the breaks, I mean, when I was first in office, we never took breaks.
That's a fairly new phenomenon.
It's a new thing. It's a new thing. I mean, we didn't get breaks. We didn't get a spring break.
And you're from the part of the state that hosts spring break often.
That's right. I remember my first year in office, and they were saying the budget was going to move early, and I said, well, I'm going with my girlfriends on a trip this weekend. And they said, no, you're not. And, you know, we'll send the police after you. So
wow.
I'm surprised that they take the breaks that they take. And it's something probably I would think in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Regina Cobb, Don Penich, thank you both so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, heartbreak, longing, pleasure. A Phoenix DJ shares her favorite love songs written by local bands.
But first, it might seem like a year ago, but it was just a few months ago that Democrats forced a government shutdown over healthcare funding. GOP leaders in Washington had refused to extend subsidies for the Affordable Care Act marketplace. In the end, they agreed to reopen the government with the promise Republicans would negotiate about the subsidies, but so far, lawmakers have not come to an agreement. Now, more than 70,000 Arizonans appear to be dropping their coverage. It all comes as enrollment in the ACA has been on the rise. Other states have been setting up their own subsidy programs to soften the blow, but our next guest this morning says she has seen a lot of Arizonans having to make difficult decisions. Claudia Maldonado is Director of Outreach and Enrollment with the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about what she's seeing.
We saw quite a few plan shifts from silver level plans to bronze. And then we also had a lot of people that looked at the bronze plans. They looked at the catastrophic plans because those are also available. And they decided to take the risk and go without.
Right. Just pay out of pocket if you happen to get sick.
Exactly. And because we work with so many federally qualified health centers, They also have a sliding fee scale program. Some of those folks decided to move to that, which is not insurance, right? It's a fee for service, but they felt that they would be better off with that versus, you know, trying to select a catastrophic plan.
This is a lot given, you know, the cost of that out-of-pocket fee. I mean, like, how much were rates going up for folks?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it was really interesting because every year the issuers have to file their rates, you know. So you see the issuers and you see if their rates are going up by 5%, 10%. And we saw rates from three issuers go up more than 40%. And so naturally, when you have that big of a jump, folks are also going to be switching their plans, right? Because those that had significant jumps, you know, that wasn't feasible for them at that point.
Yeah. Okay. So 40%, it's a big jump. I mean, like, this adds up to a whole lot of money every month that just some people could not afford.
Yes. Yes.
Talk about those catastrophic plans. It sounds like some people chose those as opposed to having no health insurance. How does that work?
They really are for that immediate emergency situation that you have. It's really not meant to be used for that person that needs ongoing care, you know, if they have a chronic health condition. So catastrophic plans have very, very high deductibles and out-of-pocket max, and they only include three primary care visits per year. And if you have any kind of health emergency, it's going to cost you so much out of your own pocket.
So there's another layer to this too, right? Which is, you know, we'll wait and see at the end of the year how many folks signed up for a plan and then ended up not being able to afford it. You anticipate those numbers being relatively high as well.
Like you had mentioned, we had less people sign up for coverage this year. And then now we're going to wait and see if they actually made that first month's payment, right? We call it that binder payment, and to actually effectuate the coverage to make it active.
So these numbers could be higher.
Yes. And so it'll be really interesting to see in the summer when they release that report of those that signed up, how many actually paid that binder payment.
70,000 might be an undercount.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, like, what you're hearing from folks. I know you started your career, you said, like, talking to people directly about why it's important to basically enroll and have health insurance. And now you're talking to people who are probably looking at not having it for the first time in a long time. What's that like? What do people say this is like for them?
It can be stressful. It's a stressful situation to be in when you are having to make decisions about your health care and your other living expenses, right? You might have rent or mortgage, childcare. All of those things can eat up your budget significantly. Healthcare is one of those things that sometimes people are willing to gamble with. Sometimes there just isn't money, a whole lot of money left over for healthcare. And so folks are actively making decisions on, can I buy more food or can I do this?
Yeah.
Right? And those are really difficult decisions to make.
There's also like a big picture system-wide kind of impact when you have a lot more people uninsured, right? Like, what are you watching on that front?
Well, what we see is naturally when you have more people go uninsured, you have a lot more people going to the emergency room at the hospital. And so folks start to use the emergency room as almost like primary care. And that's not really the intent of an emergency room, right?
Yeah.
Not only that, but it's the most expensive doctor's office you could ever go to.
Right.
Those bills can be high. They can be astronomical. And so, you know, that kind of starts this spiraling of trying to figure out how am I going to pay for this bill? And not only that, but it puts a lot of stress on our healthcare system as a whole. Hospitals are having more uncompensated care. And so it's like a ripple effect.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, you think about the rural parts of our states where healthcare is even harder to find. and they may only have one hospital and they drive hours to get there.
Yeah. So let me ask you lastly, Claudia, watching the politics around this, the back and forth in Congress, the kind of, you know, press conference after press conference, the deal making and the promise of a deal that still has not come to fruition. Do you feel like this is one of those issues that's just going to become a can we kick down the road or a kind of political football?
I think in some instances we have not paid attention enough to our communities. It's really hard to talk to folks, you know, on the daily saying, Claudia, I can't afford this medication anymore. I have to go without, but I need this medication to manage my diabetes. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to start rationing my medication. And now my diabetes is no longer controlled. And then you see, oh my gosh, this clinic or this health provider may not even be available in this rural part of the state. And a lot of people think, well, I don't live in that part of the state, right? But I see all these connections. Mm. I see almost like a web. It's a web to me. And so when certain pieces start to fall, then you start to see the domino effect of them. All of these things have to work together cohesively in order for people to thrive and be healthy between the programs and the clinical providers and the folks that are on the ground helping people navigate. All of these pieces have to work together. And so when we start moving those pieces around or maybe taking away some of those pieces, that's when you really see things start to shake.
Okay. Claudia Maldonado, Director of Outreach and Enrollment for the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers, joining us. Claudia, thank you very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Mark, I don't know about you, but this year it felt to me like the Super Bowl halftime show was almost a bigger story than the game itself.
I mean, it does kind of seem like that's the thing people are still talking about relative to the game almost a week later.
Yes. Every day, it seems like, there's another story trickling out about some extreme reaction to Bad Bunny's performance. And yesterday, I heard about a troubling incident that happened in Scottsdale.
Well, let's hear more about it.
The bars in Old Town Scottsdale are packed with sports fans almost every weekend. But last Sunday, during the Super Bowl, the scene was supercharged. There was plenty of anticipation for the game itself, but also for the halftime show, which featured Puerto Rican singer Bad Bunny performing in Spanish. At Casa Amigos, right in the heart of Old Town, the crowd didn't hear much of his performance. Just as Bad Bunny started singing, the sound of the Super Bowl broadcast abruptly cut out. Footage posted on TikTok shows what happened next. The video feed of Bad Bunny continues on a screen behind the DJ stand, and the general manager of the restaurant appears to direct the DJ to replace the audio with a remix of a 1990s rap song, Ice Ice Baby. Kim Hunt was not at Casa Amigos that night. But when she saw the video of the incident on TikTok, she was furious. Hunt is in her early 30s and lives in Scottsdale, where she's a full-time social media content creator, frequently commenting on politics. She saw the GM's choice of Ice Ice Baby as a blatant message of support for the Trump administration's ICE raids, which have often targeted the Latino community.
I am Latina myself, and I just found it incredibly hypocritical that someone who is the GM of a Spanish-named bar called Casa Amigos was so irate that the halftime show was in Spanish when his entire profitability is based on Latino culture.
Hunt also pointed out that in addition to the name of the restaurant, Casa Amigos regularly promotes Latino-themed food and events.
They have promos for Cinco de Mayo. They'll even say, like, come and fiesta with us. And obviously they'll promote things like Tequila Tuesdays.
She later posted about all this on her own TikTok channel, where her handle is Slay the GOP.
I think it's just really important that people dismantle these right-wing talking points that just aren't at all true. As someone who was born and raised in Tucson and who has relatives from Mexico, it's just deeply harmful when I see people, you know, using like immigrants as talking points to defend their racism.
In a statement posted on Instagram several days after the Super Bowl, the parent company of Casa Amigos, Evening Entertainment Group, said, quote, "We are aware of the decision made by an employee during the game this past weekend. This action does not reflect our standards or our operating procedures, which specifically included a policy of airing the full broadcast with audio." They added that the GM has been suspended indefinitely. We reached out several times to Evening Entertainment Group, as well as the GM, but have not received a reply.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Tomorrow is more than just the deadline for the Colorado River Basin states to reach an agreement. It's also Valentine's Day. And to celebrate, we wanted to feature some local musicians who've used their music to reflect on love of all kinds. We asked Ash Us, a local DJ, to pick out some of her favorites.
When I was asked to do this, my initial reaction was just a feeling of overwhelmingness. Like, there's so many talented local bands, local artists, and it was a cool chance to think about just how many local bands or musicians I listen to. It was hard to really narrow it down. So that was the first thought. And then the second thing was a fun challenge of this interpretation of love. So I wanted as well to think of love songs in the way that people might traditionally consider them in the context of Valentine's Day or whatever, but love for other things, love for community, love for self. I tried to really broaden the interpretation of love.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and in the songs that you have selected, we get the full range of that. Let's listen to the first one that you've selected. And this is a song called Sagebrush and Stone by Morphia Slow.
And I know it's not meant to be, but I love you, chickadee. But she don't love me. You love your sagebrush and stone, you sagebrush and stone. You put them in your pocket, you take them home. So you keep the desert with you, wherever you may roam.
So those are obviously some very Southwest lyrics for a love song. What made you pick this one?
Yeah, oh man, this song, this whole album from Morphia Slow, the lead singer, Aileen, her voice is just so powerful and hauntingly beautiful. There's a pitch of it, a tone of it that is just like so distinct and so compelling. And so I love her voice. I picked this song just the message about love, that line that you featured. I know it's not meant to be, but I love you, chickadee. I think that's something that so many of us can relate to, like people who we love with our whole hearts, and it's just not quite meant to be for a variety of reasons.
To the point that you maybe have a pet name for them that they don't know about?
Yes, yes, absolutely, yeah. Or like there's a lot of content about them in your group chat with your friends,
yeah,
you know,
right,
stuff like
right.
that. We can all relate to it, so I love this track.
Absolutely. So let's listen to this next one. This song is called Roses, and it's by Dolly Creamer.
My sweetheart brings me roses. He loves me, and he hates me. But he loves me, and he hates me. And I can't ever tell which one it is, because he brings me roses.
Tell us why you chose this one.
Okay, this one, her voice is really compelling, very eclectic. It has a range to it that I think a lot of people can't quite tap into or do well. And this is a newer album that she put out pretty recently, and I have a personal connection to it. I went on a backpacking trip to the Lost Coast of California, and I could only really pick a few albums to download, and this was one of them. And this song, that line, he brings me roses with fists, or brings me them with fists. It's just such a powerful image, this idea of people can be sweet and they can also be volatile. And it's just this song to me is just a beautiful representation of the human condition, that we have our flaws and we have our sweet parts as well.
Let's go now to your next selection, which is by Piyama Piyama. This is Champeta Man Finds Love. So that, when I first turned this song on, especially this, that what we just heard is from the middle of the song, but the very first part of it sounds so, it's like very Vampire Weekend, Paul Simon kind of mashup. But then obviously it's got that sense of humor that Piyama Piyama's music always has. Tell us why you selected this one.
Yeah, so the band Piyama Piyama, the music is very whimsical. And the lead singer, Jonathan, he plays a lot on like alternative dimensions, these characters that he creates. And then the music takes you through the stories of these characters. And so a lot of their music is cumbia. And this is more from the style of champeta music, which is out of Colombia. And it's a really specific Afro-Latin sound. It's from the coast of Colombia, so you see a lot of African influence. It's very traditionally associated with like resistance, liberation sounds. Champeta music also was like not very respected in the world until recently because it is intentionally chaotic, right? And it doesn't follow the traditional music structure that a lot of the Western world like esteems quite highly. So it's, you know, powerful in terms of its historical and cultural significance. But in this song, the character is finding love and it's sweet and it's just lighthearted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also more maybe traditionally danceable than the first couple songs we heard, and that is true of this next one as well. Let's hear Fleshy Musings by Jeruza Funk. So tell us why you chose this one, Ash.
I mean, we can't have a Valentine's Day playlist of sorts if we don't have a romance song. And this one's simple. It's not super deep. It's about pleasure and intimacy and that being fun. And yeah, I love it.
That was also a really fun song to listen to in the vein of what we were talking about a little bit with Piyama Piyama, because, again, we have this blend of styles. There's a lot of traditional funk sounds, and then there's a lot of influences from international music from all over the world.
Yeah, so I'm not sure specifically like their process, but I do know that the Jesse and Chris, who kind of do most of the writing for Jeruza Funk, they're like the stewards of this band. They spent several years all over Central and South America, and so a lot of the music and the rhythms that they use are inspired by their travels. It's really fun too to watch their dynamic play out when they perform this song because they are in a relationship and. It's really fun. It's such a fun one to see live. I hope everyone gets to at some point.
Well, for our last selection, Ash, let's listen to this track from Spiritual Warfare and the Greasy Shadows. This song is called I Love America. So as you were mentioning at the beginning of the conversation, Ash, we're talking about a lot of different kinds of love here. The sentiment, I love America, a very loaded thing to express always, but perhaps even more in this moment. What made you choose this one?
Yeah, this one was one that I spent a lot of time thinking about selecting. Again, obviously the sentiments about loving America, you know, that's a challenging thing depending on your experience in this country and especially given the context of the world that we're living in right now. But as you heard in the clip, this song, it's really haunting. And so the vocals are stating the words, I love America, and yet there is this really heavy, sad undertone to it. It almost reminds me of like a sound you maybe would hear at a funeral. That's like where I go when I think of this song. And I don't say that in the way of like, you know, obviously you could unpack so much about the meaning, but what I thought of when I selected this was how the lyrics reference trying times and trying times are, from my experience, the spark or what creates love.
That's a beautiful sentiment. And that line, he also references bravery, brave in these trying times. And one of the things I started spinning out on as I was listening to that line is, you know, the adjective trying evokes the idea of something being a trial, you know, like a difficult test. But you could also look at it as a time to try, you know, to actually make the effort to find the kind of sentiment that you were just expressing.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's another key part of why I love this song is, like, I would imagine, you know, part of the message would be also what you're talking about, to not give up on it. And how do we resist? And I speak from personal experience as a social worker and as someone working in a school. The school I am at, there's a lot of folks from different backgrounds and different places. And some of the middle schoolers don't say the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. And that is their choice because their families and their lives are impacted negatively by certain parts of this country right now. And I thought of that a bit when I selected this song, you know, like the idea of country is complicated to so many people right now.
Well, a complicated range of emotions in all of these songs selected today by my guest, Ash Us, who also DJs around town as DJ Trip Hazard. Ash, thank you for curating this amazing range of music, and thanks for sharing all of it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Beach boys, but no beach girls, at least not yet. Let's hope. I love America. I love America. Please slow down and draw me off a bed.
And if you want even more love songs from Phoenix bands, Ash made us a playlist. You can find it on our YouTube channel.
All right, that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Sam, I've got to ask, you know, tomorrow is Arizona's birthday. It's statehood day. Cheers. Have you gotten the state a present?
Yes. I am going to grant the state the great privilege of serving me brunch.
That seems like the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes. Yes. Well, the way I order at brunch, it's going to keep on giving.
Fair enough. All right. So, for Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show.